Money Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. And joining us now, it is a pleasure to welcome Stephen Kinzer, author of The Brothers, Reset, Overthrow, All the Shah's Men. He is a correspondent with the Boston Globe, foreign correspondent with the Globe and the New York Times, and a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and the author of a new book, and it's a very intriguing book at that, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, by Stephen Kinzer, and that's K-I-N-Z-E-R, The True Flag. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
This is, as you talk about Roosevelt and Twain, there are any number of other illustrious figures of the time, but that automatically throws us back to a time right around the turn of the last century. However, I would say that what you're writing about is as relevant today as it was 120 years ago. And that's a very central question dealing with American foreign policy. Should the United States intervene to shape the fate of other nations?
You're right. This is really the greatest question of American foreign policy. When the Senate sat down to debate it for the first time in an epic 32-day debate in 1899, one senator started off the debate by saying, "This is the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people." He was right. It was, and it still is. This is even a bigger question in a way than slavery was, because slavery only affected people living inside the United States, whereas deciding whether the U.S. was going to become a major military and naval power in the world would affect every country. So this book is a discovery of what I think is a lost episode in American history, and that's what I try to do in my books. I'm always looking for some big moment that shaped the world, but that for whatever reason we've forgotten about. So I think I was aware from my reading that there was a period around 1898, 99, when the U.S. first decided to do this, to begin projecting its power and dominating other countries. But what I had not realized, and what's the center of this book, is that we did not make this decision easily. It wasn't something that came automatically. In fact, the opposite is true. The whole United States was caught up in a big debate over whether this was a good idea or not. And this debate seized the country. It was on the front pages for weeks and months. Every major political and literary and intellectual figure in America took sides. I'm trying to recover this debate in part for the reason that you mentioned, and that is that it's uncanny. As you go through the Senate debate and everything that was said in newspapers and the public debates, how much the arguments that were made then resonate today. Every time we've debated the question of intervention somewhere else in the world, whether it's Vietnam or Central America or the Middle East, we use the same arguments that were used back in this original debate. So in the history of American foreign policy, this is really the mother of all debates. And one of the most fun things about researching it is the fact that so many colorful characters were involved in the debate. I use Teddy Roosevelt and Mark Twain as some of the most vivid ones, and their back and forth is one of the most fascinating parts of this whole story.
Well, they certainly knew how to use the language, that's for sure.
You're absolutely right. In fact, if there's a depressing part of my research, it is that I realized how much more articulate and how much more sophisticated were the senators back in those days compared to the ones we have today?
Well, they weren't restricted by 140 characters or less.
Their speeches are just gems of oratory, and they're full of historical references to ancient Rome, things you'd never think about discussing with a U.S. senator today. Even the bad guys were brilliant. So that was an inspiration, but also a little depressing.
Yeah. Well, as you say, on one side you had Mark Twain, you had William Jennings Bryant, you had, interestingly, Andrew Carnegie. On the other side you have Theodore Roosevelt, who was known as quite an orator. Henry Cabot Lodge. And let's not forget the media was involved in this one in a very big way, William Randolph Hearst.
You're right. So the imperialist triumvirate, if you want to call it that, was Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who kind of directed the project from Washington, Teddy Roosevelt as the public face, and then William Randolph Hearst as the mighty megaphone, the guy who used his newspaper to publish all kinds of false reports about the brutalities in Spain, hoping to motivate Americans to go to war there so he could sell more newspapers. He was the pioneer of what we called yellow journalism back then. Now we call it fake news, but it's the same principle. So Teddy Roosevelt and the anti-imperialist Mark Twain are marvelously matched. Teddy Roosevelt was kind of a spoiled rich kid. He had great fantasies about war as a kid. He believed war was the only noble pursuit for a man or for a country. He believed the United States was destined to dominate all the nations of the southern part of the world. Mark Twain hated this idea. He had traveled to countries where European imperialism had been quite brutal, like South Africa, and he sympathized with the native people who Teddy Roosevelt despised. He hated the idea of the foreign wars that Teddy Roosevelt found so glorious. He wrote, Twain at one point, that American soldiers fighting in foreign wars were carrying a polluted musket under a bandit's flag. He even wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbone symbols. Twain wrote that Teddy Roosevelt was clearly insane and the greatest disaster to befall our country since the Civil War. Teddy Roosevelt returned the favor by saying he would like to skin Mark Twain alive.
So not exactly bridge buddies.
Interestingly enough, though, both of them were kind of prima donnas. They created their own images, and each of them was acutely aware of how popular the other one was. So they never made these statements in public. They never denounced each other in public. In private, we know from their comments and writings how much they detested each other. But always guarding their publics and their image, they were more restrained when they were speaking in front of audiences.
Well, let's back up, and for those who are not quite up on their history, let's give a brief overview of the specific times that we're talking about, going back to 1898. And, of course, this was the time that was leading us to the Spanish-American War. Cuba, we probably remember from our school days, remember the Maine.
You're right. So Cuban revolutionaries were trying to overthrow Spanish colonial rule during the late 1890s. At this time, William Randolph Hearst, sitting in his newspaper office in New York, was looking for a way to increase his circulation. He needed a running story, the kind of story that makes people want to buy a newspaper every day. And he understood that war is the best running story of all. So he set out to set the American people on fire so they would send American troops to Cuba. He realized that once American soldiers were fighting somewhere, anybody would want to buy a newspaper every day to find out what was happening. So he published a flood of stories about terrible brutalities being perpetrated in Cuba. We now know that many of these stories were written by reporters who had never even been to Cuba. They were just imagining the whole thing. Hearst's campaign worked. The United States did decide to send troops to Cuba, and then we decided that since we were at war with Spain, there was a danger that the Spanish naval fleet could attack the U.S. mainland somewhere, so we had to find that fleet and sink it. We looked around the world for it. We finally found it in a place no American had ever heard of, and that was the Philippine Islands. So we sent a squadron there, and it sank the Spanish fleet. Spain had ruled the Philippines for centuries, and suddenly the Americans had to ask themselves, so what happens now? The Spanish are at the bottom of the ocean. What happens to the Philippines? Do we grant them independence, as they wished, or should we take them over? there was the temptation. Mm-hmm. For the first time ever in American history, we looked at the idea of creating an overseas empire. Here was a country, the United States, that had become a nation by rebelling against foreign power. Is it right for us now to exercise power over a distant land? That was the big question of that age. President McKinley imposed on Spain a treaty by which we forced them to surrender all their islands. We decided to take them over, and that treaty had to be ratified in the U.S. Senate. It was that debate that lasted 32 days and set the tenor for all the debates about intervention that have taken place ever since.
And as this was all going on, there's also the story of Hawaii that people are probably not that familiar with. This is how Hawaii became American territory.
You're right. We participated in a coup in which the Hawaiian monarchy was overthrown. And then a marvelous coincidence occurred in the spring of 1898. This is actually the story that's the first page of my book. So June 15th, 1898, was the day when we had the first anti-imperialist meeting in American history. That was at Faneuil Hall in Boston. And it started out with a clergyman making a speech in which he said, if we enter the field of conflict as a major naval and military power, we shall be just one more bully among bullies. We shall add only one more to the list of oppressors of mankind. At that same time, on that very day, the U.S. Congress was debating, also for the first time, whether to take over a foreign country, and that was Hawaii. So on that day, June 15th, 1898, the anti-imperialist movement was born, and Congress decided for the first time to take the imperial leap and seize a distant territory. That set us off on this great debate.
And it's been a debate that has continued over the years. We would be remiss if we did not say that there was also a racial element to this as well. Native Hawaiian skin color is slightly different than Mark Twain's or Theodore Roosevelt's.
You're absolutely right. Race played a big role in this debate. Teddy Roosevelt was a great believer in the hierarchy of races, that white people were born to rule and dark-skinned people were incapable of ruling themselves and had to be governed by white people. That was an idea that Mark Twain detested. But race played a big role on both sides of this debate. Now, it was logical that the imperialists would use a racist argument. They would say, those people cannot govern themselves. We have to govern them. But what was interesting is that there was a piece of the anti-imperialist movement that was also racist. So most of the anti-imperialists were great abolitionists. Many of them had been leaders in the fight against slavery and in the fight against the Ku Klux Klan and the fight for African-American rights. But there was another piece of that movement made up of Southern senators who didn't want us to take other countries because they thought if we take over countries where people have dark skins, those people will wind up ultimately in the United States, and we don't want that. So it's quite telling, a great piece of information to show you how widespread racism was in that period, that racist arguments were used on both sides of this great debate.
It's just an incredible story, and it centers around this basic question: should the United States intervene to shape the fate of other nations? It's the story of 1898 and 1899, of Cuba, of the Philippines, of Hawaii, and it's a story that doesn't end there. As we continue our conversation, we'll try and bring this story up to date as we continue with Stephen Kinzer. The book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, The True Flag by Stephen Kinzer. More in just a moment. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're talking with Stephen Kinzer, and he is the author of a new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. We've been talking about the story of the Spanish-American War, kind of an overlooked war between the Civil War and the war to end all wars, World War I. Really, there wasn't a great loss of American lives. There were lives lost on both sides, but it wasn't this huge, huge ongoing battle that went on and on. The United States went in and basically exerted its military muscle, and from there it was a matter of, well, what do we do with what we got now? But it didn't stop there. That unleashed something in the American psyche. It has changed how America has conducted itself as a nation and continues to this day.
You're right. The war in Cuba was not much of a war as far as the U.S. was concerned. We only fought for actually a couple of days of combat. Many more people died of disease than died of bullets. But it was different in the Philippines. The United States had to send tens of thousands of troops over there, and hundreds of thousands of Filipinos ultimately were killed in that war. So this was a war we've forgotten, but of course the Filipinos have not forgotten it. You're right that it set us off on this path. The Philippine War was very brutal. It also brought us our first torture scandal, in which we found American soldiers routinely involved in water torture, what we call now waterboarding. I think this led Americans to look in the mirror and say, you know, if we're going to be a power that goes off around the world and tries to make other people do what we want, we're going to have to do some bad things. And that's just what comes with the territory. So in a way, it was a loss of innocence. We began to assume that this was something other imperial powers did, and we would do it too. So since then, with various tools, we've set out to try to shape the world as we think it should be. We developed, in this period, an idea that I think many of us still have, which is that we know what's good for the world better than the world itself knows. We believe that we have a key to success as a nation, and we want to spread this all over the world. It's difficult for us to understand that there are many peoples in the world who don't want to live like us, who don't want our political or economic or religious systems, and would like to proceed as their culture tells them. Americans have an innate drive to win, to dominate, to command, and this has brought us much pain because we launch interventions that seem to succeed at first, because we have such great military power, but ultimately they wind up in many cases not only harming the target country, but sapping our own national security.
It cost in many ways. It cost to be this military powerhouse. We have a military and spend more on our military than the next seven countries behind us combined.
And we're still trying to increase it. I find this odd. Do we think as a deterrent that some terrorist is going to think, you know, America used to have 10 aircraft carriers, and I was willing to attack America, but now they have 11? Yeah. I think I'm too scared now. I'm going to stop.
Our first president warned us about all this, didn't he?
I became an even greater admirer of George Washington as I went through this book project. His farewell address is so poignant, because he warns of all the traps that could bring America down in the world, and we've seemed to have fallen into all of them. He tells us the things not to do. He says, for example, do not imagine that America has a common interest with another country when no real common interest exists. Avoid having excessive preference for one country and excessive hostility to another. And at the end of his speech, he says, can it be that Providence has not connected the felicity of a nation with its virtue? We've forgotten that, and I think there's probably a lot of spinning in the grave going on out at Mount Vernon.
And there's still a lively debate on which is the best way to go. But this is an interesting book. If you want some history as a guidepost, The True Flag by Stephen Kinzer. The True Flag. Very intriguing book and very timely. Stephen, thank you so much.
Wonderful to be with you.